from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Americans for Tax Reform. President Grover Norquist has made no secret of his ultimate goal. He has famously said he wants to shrink government, quote, to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub. And his taxpayer protection pledge, which asks candidates to commit to opposing all tax increases, has been signed by 219 House members and 39 senators, as well as over 1,000 state office holders. We want to talk with him this half hour about the current budget battles in Washington, the future of the Republican Party, tax pledges, and much more. And welcome, Grover Norquist. Good to have you aboard.
Good to be with you.
I guess the place to begin here is, does the tax pledge still have the force that it had, seeing as in 2012 all but one GOP candidate signed on, and there have been some losses in the Senate and the House, haven't there?
Well, first of all, we had a tremendous gain in 2010, and then the Democrats won some seats back in 2012. That's correct. But obviously the gain in 2010 was rather dramatic. So we now have a majority of the members of the House who've made the commitment to vote against all efforts to raise taxes, strong showing in the Senate, and as you said, about over 1,200 guys in state legislative level, quite a number of governors. Pledge actually is significantly more powerful today than it was a year ago, and the reason for that is that up until January 2nd of this year, we lived in an upside-down world where if nothing happened, the 2001 Bush tax cuts, the 2003 Bush tax cuts, and the alternative minimum tax patch, which protected the alternative minimum tax, which hits 3 to 4 million people, from hitting 30 million people, all of those tax cuts disappeared automatically on January 1st of this year. And unless the House and the Senate and the President agreed on an alternative to letting them lapse, then you would have had a $500 billion tax increase in 1 year, this year alone, $500 billion. What happened was 85% of the tax cuts were made permanent, a dollar amount, for 98-99% of the American people. So now the only way to raise taxes in the United States is not just to sit on your hands and let them raise automatically, which was an option for, I mean, every 2 years they'd set the alternative minimum tax patch, continue. Every few years they continued the Bush 2001-2003 tax cuts, including Obama in 2010. He extended all of those things for 2 years, but then they lapsed at the end of 2012. So we now have a normal situation. The only way to raise taxes is for the House and the Senate to vote them tax increases, and the president to sign it. And with this House and this Senate, they're not going to be raising taxes.
Of course, the president could have held out for another year to negotiate over sequestration, but the fiscal cliff and all that led you to make a deal where the Bush cuts went back. Essentially, you kind of finessed the president in a way. At least that's according to some people, the way some people see it.
Well, the president made a strategic error, which cost him at least the next 2 years of his presidency and maybe the next four. And the reason is, had he just extended the Bush tax cuts and the AMT patch for a year or two, he would have had all the cards. In the November-December, quote-unquote, negotiations over the fiscal cliff, Barack Obama had all the cards. He had all the power. The Republicans, I don't know what the Republicans thought they were doing sitting in the room negotiating with a guy who had all the power. You may remember Boehner, Speaker Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House, recounted that he had said to the president, well, if we allow $600 billion of what would have been $5 trillion in tax increases to take effect, so, you know, just a fraction, 15% of what you could have extracted to take effect, what do we get in the way of spending restraint? And the president says, nothing. I don't have to give you anything. I can just take that. And he did. There was no spending restraint in the president's mind or plans or deal that he did. So he had all the clout, and he gave it away. He gave it away by making the tax cuts permanent. There is nothing that Obama wants that the House needs.
We're talking, by the way, with Grover Norquist, who's with us from the nation's capital and is the president of Americans for Tax Reform, and who probably has never, seen a tax he doesn't dislike or wants to get rid of. In fact, death and taxes are supposed to be inevitable. But from Mr. Norquist's perspective, I think it's safe to say maybe taxes should not be looked at as inevitable, which prompts me to ask you, especially since you were at CPAC talking about branding the Republican Party as being like Coke with a rat head at the bottom for those who would be in favor of taxes, and you've made it very clear that any Republican who is in favor of any kind of tax should not be supported. There are some who say that's sacred and others who say that's a kind of omerta or blood oath. Let me just ask you kind of a flat question I've always wanted to ask you. Nothing to do with flat taxes, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I remember back in my civics class, we said, well, government should be civic government, at least in the highest order, ought to be about compromise, ought to be about negotiations. How can you just essentially make every legislator say on the state level, on the national level, I will not under any circumstances go forward with any tax? I mean, isn't it pretty much going against the idea of compromise, government as a civil kind of compromise?
No, not at all. What you have is people want power. Politicians say to the American people, to the voters of Pennsylvania or a congressional district, please give me power. Please let me be one of 100 senators, one of 435 congressmen. And people say, and what will you do with that power? Well, the Constitution is a list of things that either the elected officials are allowed to do or in the Bill of Rights, a list of things they're not allowed to do. So there's no compromising on that sort of thing. You cannot tell us what church to go to. You can't. You can't.
Yeah, but you
not
can.
An option,
you
okay?
can say optionally that there are a lot of loopholes and inequities in this system, and there has to be a better system, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. And the tax payer protection pledge that I share with candidates, but the candidates make that commitment to their voters. Their commitment is to voters. Now, some people run. I mean, Ted Kennedy always said, I'm not signing a pledge. I'll raise taxes when I feel like it. And I'll tell you when I'm going to take your – I'll tell you after I raise your taxes. I don't get promised I won't raise your taxes. I'll do what I want. You vote for me, I have no limits on what I will do to you in terms of taxes. I'm promising you nothing. And some people vote for politicians who – promise them nothing. I will do what I want, and you will like it. And others say, actually, I'd rather have somebody who will tell me ahead of time what they will and won't do with the power they're asking to wield over my life. And a majority of the members of the House of Representatives have been elected with a commitment, I'm not going to raise your taxes. Now, when you say you're not going to raise taxes, what does it mean? It means, one, tax reform, absolutely tax reform. The 1986 Tax Reform Act that Reagan oversaw, reduced rates, broadened the base, no net tax increase, eliminated a lot of deductions and credits. The Ryan budget plan that all of the Republicans in the House have voted for and supported takes the top rates to 25%, broadens the base, no net tax increase, eliminates deductions, credits, loopholes. That's a great idea. I think people should generally be supportive of getting rid of politically determined loopholes in the tax code and get rates as low as possible.
And you were prompted by President Reagan, I know, in your whole crusade and when it began. But I'm just wondering, you know, there was Tom C. We just had on the air with us Tom Steyer, a name you may or may not know, a billionaire who also signed a pledge. It was a pledge with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to essentially give half of his fortune to charity. And there are a lot of people who feel their taxes ought to go for social welfare, or they argue that as opposed to power, you know, and they stand behind that. And there's a lot of money. I asked Tom Steyer, I said, a lot of money hedge fund people get away with in terms of taxes, wouldn't you say? And he said, absolutely. He said, I would be in favor of equity there. Now, does that mean if the legislator's made a pledge, he can't put more pressure on a hedge fund person who is getting all kinds of tax breaks?
Well, you could eliminate a tax credit in one area as long as it was revenue neutral, as long as the goal wasn't to increase the total tax burden on the American people. You can get rid of tax credits for goofy stuff like windmills and solar power and other, you know, politically cylindras, okay? No tax credits for cylinders, no tax credits for ethanol. Get rid of those tax credits, have across-the-board fairness. There's a great piece of legislation put forward by a Kansas congressman that gets rid of all targeted tax credits for the energy industry, oil, natural gas, all the various, energy out of watercress or whatever it is that they're subsidizing through the tax code this year, gets rid of all of them and reduces marginal tax rates by a small amount so that it's revenue neutral. What the Taxpayer Protection Pledge protects against, and what's very important to protect against, is using the term tax reform as a Trojan horse for raising the tax burden on the American people. That's traditionally what politicians, when they say they want tax reform, what they really mean is, please look at my left hand while I pick your pocket.
Well, what they other mean is we want tax reform so that the very wealthy pay something that is at least deemed equitable. Now, I know one person's equitability is another person's picking in the pocket, but the fact of the matter is that we have a lot of loopholes and a lot of, I mean, Warren Buffett has said, for example, how come I have to pay less taxes than my secretary?
Well, let's be careful here. He pays significantly more in taxes than his secretary. He has, when challenged, how much do you pay your secretary, so we can check this, refused to say how much he pays his secretary. I think what he means is that the tax on ordinary income that his secretary pays, who makes more than $250,000 evidently, $50,000 evidently, nicely paid secretary, which is why he doesn't tell you, because then it doesn't sound quite as cool if he'd let you know how much he paid his secretary. And he says the interest, or the, what he gets on capital gains on money that he already paid taxes on once. When you pay capital gains tax is now 23-24% tax on that. That's money that you already paid ordinary income taxes on when you earned it, and then you invest it, and then you pay taxes on it again in capital gains. You pay taxes on it again if you invest it in the stock market through the corporate income tax, and if you're stupid enough to die, they take half. So the government comes and taxes income again and again and again, and Warren Buffett confuses the second time he pays taxes on something with the first time that he paid taxes on it and the first time that somebody else pays taxes on it. But as we've pointed out to Warren Buffett, we sent him a nice letter. There is a nice piece at the at the website of the IRS where if Warren Buffett really believes that he should pay higher taxes, he can write a check tomorrow. In point of fact, he's just a hypocrite who wants other people to pay higher taxes because he could pay higher taxes tomorrow. Mr. Stiers could write a check tomorrow. In fact, what you said he pledged to was a pledge not to pay taxes. Because when you say, I'm going to give my money away, I'm not going to die and let the government take half of it, he's avoiding taxes through the death tax. So what he's told you, Mr. Stiers said, you know what? I don't think the government spends its money wisely, and when I die, I'm going to decide who it goes to. It's not going to the government. People who say that they want to give their money away at the end of their life rather than be hit by the death tax are expressing contempt for what the government does with money, and they say, I'm not letting them decide. I'm going to decide myself. It's an interesting concept, but it runs, and I'm not opposed to that. I think it's probably
well. You're opposed
true.
To the death tax. I've read articles that you've written about that, and even opposed to internet taxing. So, like I said, you've never met a tax that you really like. I think.
The question of what level taxation you have. The answer is less than we have right now, significantly less. But the government is significantly larger than it has been in the past, and we can save a lot of money if we would simply be serious about reforming government. And that's why the reason not to raise taxes is, one, American people should not be more heavily burdened than they already are, and two, you never reform government if tax increases are an option.
Let me remind listeners.
Only reform government when they're not an option.
I want to remind listeners, Grover Norquist with us, President of Americans for Tax Reform, and also since this is only a half-hour segment, you may want to join in here, and let me tell you how you can do that. A number of ways. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page or our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I would like to get some take from you also on the Republican Party and a few other matters. I ought to mention that you're going to be here giving a lecture on Right on Crime, Why Conservatives Must Lead the Way on Criminal Justice Reform, Sentence Reductions, and Mass Incarceration. That's April 4th at Stanford Law School. And these are positions that might surprise some people. I mean, as a leader of the Republican Party and as kind of a beacon to many conservative Republicans, you want to see sequestration on defense stay in place, and you want to essentially reform prison so that we're not incurring the kind of costs that we're incurring. Huh?
Yeah, well, there are two things. One is, if you think national defense is important, you want to make sure that money isn't wasted. You recognize that just because the government or a government agency says that they need something doesn't mean it's true. And just because you call something national defense doesn't make it national defense. You can be talked into spending money that's wasted. And so you should look at the Pentagon's budget with a serious questioning eye, where you ask, how are you spending the money? How wisely are you spending the money? Do we need to spend the money this way? Can we reform government so that it costs less? And that's true for the Pentagon as much as farm subsidies. And we should be very careful in how we spend every penny. I was very pleased that the overwhelming Republican response to the sequester was, go ahead. The Pentagon can take a haircut. The Pentagon can be treated as you treat the rest of the government, and saying, let's reform government. The Republicans have twice voted to give the Pentagon more flexibility in how they save money, but not changing by a dollar the amount of money that the Pentagon is expected to reduce its spending from projections over the next decade. On right on crime, this is a very interesting one. A number of us have been working for maybe a decade in Washington, and we discovered people in other states.
Let me, excuse me for interrupting, but mention that you backed Proposition 36 and you wanted three-strike reform way back when, didn't you?
Yes, and I think that one of the things Republicans and conservatives particularly can do is speak to the criminal justice system, the prison system, the cost of those, and the human cost in keeping people incarcerated and how long you keep them incarcerated. You know, what's the point of keeping 75-year-olds in prison in a way that liberals can't? I'm from Massachusetts. Originally, I was going to be I don't know if it's still going to happen, but I was going to be on a podium with my former governor, Michael Dukakis. I don't think that worked out for this event at Stanford. But the left doesn't have a lot of credibility on the question of criminal justice issues because people think they want to let all these guys out of prison. And when conservatives say, look, we're serious about crime, we're serious about punishing crime, we want to deter crime, it is just and virtuous, there should be some prisons, I'm in favor of executing murderers. So, but let's ask ourselves how much punishment is necessary, useful, and what kind of costs you want to impose. I mean, human costs. I mean, there are all sorts of questions you get into when you look at prisons and the judicial system in terms of making sure that you get serious justice and that the punishment is reasonable and that you don't end up with prisons full of guys involved in victimless crimes.
Well, we have a lot of people who want to talk with you and a lot of emails coming in. I'm going to try to get to as many of them as I can, but I did mention that I wanted to find out by your lights what's going to be happening with the GOP and up ahead. I mean, you said that you were very happy about sequestration and the attitude toward defense, trying to maybe change some minds on three strikes. There's been a lot of talk about Republicans bending on immigration, new policies for Republicans, new ways of looking at things, particularly because of the loss suffered in the last presidential election. How do you see it? I mean, you see it moving toward maybe more liberalism?
Certainly not more liberalism. I don't consider our efforts on right on crime to have anything to do with being liberal. It has everything to do with being smart and tough on crime. And on immigration, what the Republicans are looking to move towards is Ronald Reagan's position, hardly a liberal position. We ought to be bringing all the smart guys in the world here. We ought to have a guest worker program so that farm workers and others can come and go home and come and work. And we should certainly deal with 10 or 11 million people who are here who need to be have earned legal status so they can not have to worry about the IRS, ICE, bothering them in their workplace. These are all positions that the modern Republican Party under Reagan and both Bushes have staked out. And it's one that organized labor was and is, if you look at what's happening right now in D.C., the number one stumbling block to immigration reform is the AFL-CIO's objection to any ability to let low-skilled people come into the country to work and to have some sort of guest worker program. They're going nuts on the subject. It's what's holding things up. It's what killed it real progress back in 86, and it's what killed it in 2007.
We're talking again with Grover Norquist. I want to get to some callers, Mr. Norquist.
Sure.
Forgive me, but I want to just mention Grover Norquist again is president of Americans for Tax Reform. And according to Lawrence O'Donnell, the most powerful man in America who does not sleep in the White House, and what you might not know is that he's also a former editor of the Harvard Crimson. He mentioned his Massachusetts pedigree, so I wanted to get that in with his other bona fides, member of the National Rifle Association Board and writer for the American Spectator. Let me get some callers on. Peter, good morning. You're on.
Yes, hi. Your speaker said that Warren Buffett's money is being, and others are being taxed twice when they put taxed money into stocks or bonds and then pay capital gains. Well, there is no tax if there's no capital gain, and the capital gain is a fresh income on which they're paying tax for the first time. So I think he's misstated and exaggerated what the tax burden is.
Grover Norquist.
Okay, you earn a dollar, you pay taxes. The government takes 10%. Then you take what's left, your 90 cents, and you put it in the bank. You get interest. The government wants to tax that. I'm sorry, we're working off the same dollar, and they're taxing it again. So I view it as and then if you die and the government wants to take, you know, up until we got a little cut recently, but up until recently it was half, the government takes another bite at it. But I certainly see it as repeated bites at the same dollar you earned one time and you already paid taxes on it. The government ought to tax you once and go away.
Let me thank Peter for the call. Actually, a lot of web comments, but I'll get to some of your emails here. Here's Susan who says, this man infuriates me. Only a legislator for whose position he can personally vote should be answerable to him for any position they take on anything. They should be answerable only to their constituents. He exemplifies unmitigated gall. And opposing taxes is un-American. Is Grover a traitor? Just to give you a sample of some of the emails that are coming in, but also some web comments that I wanted to read here. David writes, the U.S. has one of the lowest overall tax rates in the developed world, taxes as percentage of GDP. We also have worse health care, worse poverty, higher incarceration rates, and a host of other quality of life indicators that are quite low. Could you ask Mr. Norquist if there's a country he can point to presently or historically that enjoyed a better quality of life with an overall tax burden equal to or lower than ours right now?
First question was the assertion that somehow pledge takers make a pledge to me. I think the person was not listening. The pledge, if you read it, you go to our website, atr.org, the pledge is to the American people and to the people of their state. It's not to me. I know that Harry Reid misstates that, and the caller may be listening to Harry Reid, but they should go and read the pledge itself. And then they would be glad to know that no one is making any commitments to me. They are making commitments only to their constituents.
But if they break that pledge, you come down on them, right?
Well, actually, they're not worried about me. They're worried about their constituents.
Well, your organization comes down on them, though, and makes, shall we say, it difficult for them to raise money from other sources in the
GOP.
Well,
actually, I don't know that we even put a press release when George Herbert Walker Bush broke his pledge because the whole world noticed it, and they threw him out of the White House. I didn't have to throw a rock at him. The American people said you weren't going to do that, and you did it. Goodbye.
Read my lips, huh?
Read my lips. And look, the American people don't like to be lied to. It's not a good idea to lie your way into office, and I encourage everyone to be up front. If you're going to raise their taxes, tell them that you're going to raise your taxes when you feel like it, and they better get used to being ridden. And if your position is you're not going to raise their taxes, keep your word. And I think if you look at high tax states versus low tax states, it's a little difficult to compare one country with another, but it's pretty easy to compare California and Texas. And people leave one state and they move to the other. It's pretty easy to compare Illinois and Indiana next to each other, same weather. Indiana, lower taxes, right to work state. Illinois, high tax state, Illinois did what California did. They raised sales tax, raised the income tax. They have a Democratic governor, House, Senate. They raised all the taxes. So did Minnesota. So did Maryland. So did New York. So did Connecticut. So did Massachusetts. Those are the completely blue Democrat states, governor, House, Senate, all raised taxes. And then other states have been reducing taxes.
Well, as long as we're talking about California, we had a segment on before about the bankruptcy in Stockton, and it was really essentially creditors, bond creditors, and purse people, that is, public funding and particularly pension-funded folks who were going at one another in that whole trial, the city of Stockton. Now, the creditor said, you haven't done enough. You haven't cut, you haven't raised taxes, and they're not going to get their money. Should Stockton have raised taxes under those circumstances? Because the creditors are out $300, $400 million.
One, don't lend money to politicians and to governments that don't have any restraint in how they spend. They will go bankrupt, and it's your money, and you can't give money to people that are going to act crazy and then ask, hey, how come the crazy person wasted my money? It's your responsibility when you make a lousy loan. Other cities are responsible in how they spend, or more responsible. California and Illinois have real problems. Right now, the unfunded liabilities on the state pension systems are not sustainable. There's a very interesting debate about whether states can go bankrupt or should be allowed to go bankrupt. I've seen it argued both ways. Certainly, cities and towns and counties can and have often. Some of them, it takes a bankruptcy before they reform. We're going through this in Detroit right now. Better off to have limited spending, limited taxes, and economic growth. And if you look at the highest tax states, people are leaving them. And the lowest tax states, people are moving there. So if you want to know what the American people want, you can tell they move out of high tax areas, big government areas, areas where the cities, counties, states, where the government does many things for you.
Well, here's a listener who writes, Glenn says, these no-tax pledges are the only thing keeping us from turning into Greece. Most of the comments are not necessarily along those lines. Just read a few more. Lee writes, tax-averse politicians are often heard to claim that corporate taxes are job killers. I check with my accountant and I'm told that taxes are levied on corporate profits after salaries and expenses are paid. In my company, we always maximized our investment in salaries and capital equipment and never paid taxes. Corporate taxes, therefore, are a strong incentive to hiring and investment. How does Mr. Norquist reconcile his views on corporate taxation with the facts of the tax laws? And we've got less than a minute left. Grover Norquist.
Look, corporations don't pay taxes. People pay taxes. Corporations collect taxes. And all corporate taxes end up being paid by people. And politicians like to hide taxes. When you go to the grocery store, you pay the corporate income tax for the grocery store. You pay the property tax for the grocery store. The grocery store does not pay the sales tax. You do. Politicians like to pretend that somebody other than you is paying the taxes, but if you live in California, you've figured it out. You're paying the taxes.
Well, we're going to have you back. I hope you'll return because
be delighted.
So many people who'd like to talk to you. And you can actually see Grover Norquist. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this Thursday at 6 p.m. Another hour ahead with Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, won the prize in economics, Daniel Kahneman. When we return, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.